Well, I think I'll get started. There'll probably be a few more people that sneak in here. Jamie Shake has been here giving some talks on geology, both local and Pacific Northwest. This is my last lecture. For those that are just popping in, this is 10 Mile Creek from Martin's Ridge. A little bit earlier this week. North Cascades geology with a Holden twist. Yesterday I talked about a lot of other parts of the Pacific Northwest. I excluded the North Cascades just because it's a particularly interesting place. It's a striking location, and of course we're right in the middle of it, so it seemed appropriate to give it a little bit more time than some of the other regions. Let's see here, is this going to go? Anyway, so this is a tunnel over near New Halem, and it was a tunnel that leads from the Gorge Dam down to the Gorge Powerhouse, and it's constructed in the Skagit River gneiss, which I'll talk a little bit more. When you go down to Lucerne, you'll be looking at the same rocks as were tunneled there in New Halem. And we actually investigated. They're going to put another tunnel in there for water, but it's a beautiful rock. So just a little refresher, everybody's probably like, oh, it's got this up again. But so Seduction Zone and the North Cascades is no exception to that. The basic mechanism is that you have an oceanic plate. It's subducted down underneath a thicker, more buoyant continental crust. You have earthquakes. Eventually it starts to melt, which creates volcanoes. Most pertinent to the North Cascades is that as you're going along, the whole package doesn't just nicely slide underneath, and this actually acts as kind of a knife, and you start having pieces of the top sliced off and accreted onto the adjacent crust. So you just sort of think of it as, what's the analogy, like slicing cheese with a cheese slicer. You know, we're just taking the top off and just slapping it on next to it, and then we're compressing it and burying it and playing with it. So terrain accretion, back around 300 million years ago, the coastline of North America was way over in Montana. And over that ensuing 200 million years or so, what happened is we had a subduction zone environment where we had repeated chunks of other exotic terrains that were floating on the ocean crust. Some of them were beautiful Caribbean reefs. Some of them were just volcanic arcs, lava flows and volcanoes, and a lot of sediments, of course, because the ocean is full of sediments. And over again, these would come along and they'd kind of get squished up and thrust onto or compressed into the North American craton. And in the North Cascades, basically, this is all just these little pieces of accreted terrains, that, as they call them, that have been slammed together, and they have broken the North Cascades down into sort of three domains. You've got the Western Domain, the Menemorphic Core Complex, there's Glacier Peak, so we're sitting somewhere right here in the middle of it all, and the Metal Domain. They're all separated by large faults. And one side of the fault, you'll have a high-grade metamorphic rock. Metamorphic rock is a rock that's been put under temperature and pressure to change the mineral assemblage and the texture of the rock to be in equilibrium with the conditions that it is in. And generally speaking, the Western Domain is a lower grade metamorphic rock. So you can still see fossils in the limestones. You can still see a lot of the original structure. It's been heavily modified by faulting, compression. So you've got a lot of broken assemblages. Melanges is what we call them, which is a geologist term for a garbage terrain. So it's got chunks of everything in it. The metamorphic core complex, or metamorphic core domain, is typically high grade metamorphics. They've gone under a lot of burial In some cases, these terrains were sort of launched up and over, thrust on top of these. That whole complex has been uplifted over time. It was probably buried between 15 and 30 kilometers below ground surface. And now here it is as mountains. And then the Metau domain is also a relatively low grade temperature, low pressure temperature terrain. It's also been heavily faulted and broken up because of all this accretionary processes. This is a view of, actually I'm going to go back just a sec. So the Straight Creek Fault is one of these main fault lines, and then the Ross Lake Fault, it's really a fault zone. The Straight Creek is actually, you can actually go out and stand on top of it. This is up near Darrington, and you're looking right along this. There's actually a great view. I didn't actually include this in the slideshow, but if you go up on Martin's Ridge, there's a fault that runs right down that looks almost exactly like this. Next, if anybody goes back up there, you'll walk along and all of a sudden there's this little notch to the side. You're like, wow, why is that all red? And it's a big fault that runs right through that ridge line.
So where's the one that goes down into the valley from the...
It goes down into Ten Mile Creek.
Yeah.
And then it actually cuts, the angle of the fault sort of cuts across the Holden drainage at an angle.
Okay.
And I hadn't noticed before until I was practically standing on it.
How far up the ridge or along the ridge is it?
Let's see. So if you go up from Ten Mile Creek, you go up over that first knoll, uh-huh. And then there's a couple of saddles there, and I think it's really the first main
right
saddle.
Right at the beginning.
Yeah, it's pretty early on. So, but it's a pretty impressive feature. Those major faults had both what we call strike slip, which is moving side to side, as well as normal actions or movement. So a lot of movement was this sort of strike slip sense. And how we know this is that there have been several terrains that we can match on the other side of these faults. In this case, the Bridge River terrain can be matched all the way up 100 miles north of where to other terrain. I don't think it's called Bridge River up in Canada, but you know, you had essentially, and this is happening in California too, along the San Andreas Fault. There are blocks that can be matched across the San Andreas Fault for hundreds of miles, basically, at this time. So just an example of the amount of displacement and deformation that's occurred along some of these structures. So within the terrains within domains, and here's the Straits Creek Fault again. Here's the, let's see here. The Ross Lake Fault running through here, and this is, you know, it just keeps getting more and more complicated as you keep going in. You know, we had three domains, now we have several dozen terrains, and those terrains are fairly general groupings, if you will. Again, relatively low pressure and temperature deformed rocks, much higher pressure and temperature deformed rocks, and then back to the lower deformed rocks. And this is a block, like I mentioned, that's been brought up. We are, Holden, here's Tahikan right here, we are in the middle of the Chelan Mountain terrain in Holden. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the terrains in the western western domain. I'll spend more time, obviously, in the Chelan or the sort of metamorphic core. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in the Metau this afternoon. On top of all this sort of slamming everything together and thickening of the crust, there's been extensive intrusion of the crust by plutons. And that's occurred through a variety of mechanisms. One, heating because of the subducting slab bringing magma up, as well as the temperature. You know, when you put things under a lot of pressure, you just raise the temperature of that material, and it starts to create melt. So you can just, you know, all these different bodies are intrusions. And as we get to Holden specific geology, you'll find that most of the rocks in this valley are some sort of intrusive. And there's actually relatively little rock that's not. The mine is being, of course, one of those exceptions to that. This is a very general section. Here's west to east, generally speaking. This is a little further north, more towards Nehalem. But in here, they've basically shown like the Straight Creek Fault as more of a normal fault. And again, there's also Ross Lake, but as I was shown earlier, there's actually quite a bit of lateral displacement as well. Orthognice is a term I'll probably throw out several times. Here's the Skagit orthognice. And basically, an orthognice is like a granite that's been cooked a second time. So it changes the mineral assemblages, it changes the texture of the rock, but essentially you've just taken a granite and you've reheated it. All right, so Western Domain, I chose the Chilliwack terrain, in part because I've worked in it, so I know a little bit more about it. It's an oceanic assemblage, mostly sedimentary rocks, also some volcanics. This is actually at the Baker Lake Dam. This is just downstream of the dam, and you can see the layering here. This is probably limestone here. This is sort of a limey mudstone, sort of ocean floor type deposit. You can see it's been obviously tilted, deformed. You really can't trace beds through here in any significant distance. It's been pretty damaged. One thing that you can see down at the bottom here, so this is leakage out of the dam. Leakage is usually not what you want in a dam. If it had been a high-grade metamorphic rock, you wouldn't have leakage because marble doesn't dissolve readily, but limestone does. So through fractures and crevices in the rock, they've had water that started flowing, and over time, it's just eroded away through dissolution. And created some significant piping issues. I can't remember what the numbers are, but that it's quite an issue for them at that particular dam. So another terrain that I thought I would mention is the Eastern terrain. They call it the Melange Belt here. It's close to the Straight Creek Fault. And what I thought was interesting about this particular terrain over some of the others is that it's called a blue schist facies. It experienced blue schist facies deformation. And that means that basically it was thrust down underground 15, 30 kilometers and then exhumed before it was able to heat up relative to the surrounding rock. So that creates a very unique, very beautiful blue, it's called an amphibole. It's an iron magnesium silicate. Mineral that is in equilibrium under high temperature, high pressure, but low temperature conditions. So it's really limited just to subduction zones. This was actually out of the book, Regurgitation. I thought that was pretty awesome. But it rust out very quickly before it was able to heat up to the adjacent
area. What's considered rapid?
Probably still millions of years. So it's all, geologists don't want to rush in. Lots of time to work it out. So the metamorphic core complex, Skagit River Gneiss, as I mentioned earlier, it starts up in Nehalem or extends past Nehalem up along the Skagit River, and then obviously it's quite prevalent. I think it extends all the way to Stehekin along the river, along the lake here. Here's a couple of core samples. We actually did quite a bit of work up in the Nehalem area on this gneiss. They're looking at a new tunnel through there to enhance their reduce their head loss essentially for the powerhouse. Here's some cores. We go out and we drill holes and we collect solid core pieces of the rock to sort of understand if it's a good rock or is it bad rock. And it's really, it's beautiful rock. Here's a sample that looks almost like a granite. You know, the minerals don't seem to be particularly aligned in any particular direction. The Skagit River gneiss is a fairly high-grade gneiss, and there's actually a lot of sort of very intricate folding and bending and banding of minerals in a lot of the rock. This is all considered the same rock type. So as I throw some of these sort of terrains up or rock units, understand that you're not going to go out and necessarily see the same thing the whole time. This I thought was hilarious. Someone had this on Google Earth, and it's a beautiful exposure of the gneiss, and he called it something like gravel pit or something like that. And this is a job that I worked on just east of Nehalem. We had this is in 2003, and approximately 1 million cubic yards of rock failed off of a ridge slope, some of it falling onto SR-20, closing the highway at the time. And we spent several months up there trying to figure out what to do, and ultimately what they decided to do is put in a big rock catchment area. So this is not like a natural pit slope or anything at all. This is a carefully blasted up slope, and actually if you drive that way, you'll see it as, I think it looks like a, you know, like a green worm lying on the ground, but it's basically a big berm that they use to try to keep rocks, large rocks, from falling off there. But it's a great exposure of the rock itself. Another terrain that I thought was worth talking a little bit about is called the Ingalls terrain, and it's pretty small in the grand scheme of everything else. There's Tahikan up there, Winthrop, Twisp, but it's important because it's a great example of what we call an ophiolite sequence. It's got a variety of deformation. Metamorphism is pretty. It's not a very clean area. There's a lot of deformed rock. What I thought was interesting is that I've often thought that, you know, so an ophiolite sequence, just backing up a little bit, maybe I'll just step to the next slide because it'll be easier to explain it. An ophiolite sequence is basically a cross-section of the ocean crust. So if you think of an ocean crust forming at the very bottom underneath the crust is the mantle. And that's typically very iron-rich, heavy metals, iron, and mostly iron. And then as you move up in section, you start getting into sort of less primitive material. Then you get into what's called sheeted dikes. And that is, if you were at a mid-ocean ridge, you've got the mantle, you've got material that's sort of upwelling through other rocks, and it comes up in these dikes trying to get to the surface. I don't know if anybody's ever seen the videos of lava erupting underwater. It creates these kind of pillow-like features. So on top of these dikes where lava is trying to get to the ocean floor, then it reaches the floor and then it chills in these pillows. That's at the spreading center, the rifting zone. As you move away, you have sediment that starts to accumulate on that. So deep ocean sediments, a lot of silts and mudstones, and so that's what you would typically see at the top. There's a great exposure in southwestern Oregon in the Klamath terrain. That's essentially a relatively undeformed section, and the Ingalls terrain is not quite as pretty, but believed to be correlated with the Josephine ophiolite. One of the things I mentioned yesterday is that a lot of these terrains extend from one location to the other, and or it can be mapped between exposures from over large areas. So here we are in the North Cascades, and we can correlate that with southwestern Oregon. All right, so whole area geology, as I mentioned, we're in the Chelan Mountains terrain. This is a 1 to 100,000 scale map that I'm using today. There's also a 7.5 minute quad map that's up from the, in the mine museum. And if anybody wants to take a look at that, I'm happy to walk through it with them. There's a lot more detail on that. This lumps and that splits. So, but for discussion purposes, I could go way down the rabbit hole on that one, and I think it's probably healthier to stay out of that. Here's Cloudy Peak, just as reference points. Here's the peak. Here's Dumbbell, Copper, let's see, Buckskin. This is Martin's Ridge running through here. Here's Holden, Lucerne. Here's the, this is actually the Skagit Gneiss, it's labeled TKSG, and you can see it runs all the way up, heading right up north, and will eventually run into the Skagit River. The stippled area is glacial deposits, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. The ore body is in this band of, it's basically a schist and gneissic assemblage. So a schist is a high-grade metamorphic rock that typically has micas and both muscovite and biotite. It's got quartz and feldspars and varying amounts of, you know, garnet or tourmaline or other types of minerals. The assumed sort of protolith of this, which would be the rock that it was deformed from, is some sort of oceanic combination of both marine sediments and also the same sort of sheeted dikes and mid-ocean ridge units that we that I was talking about a minute ago. One of the areas that they see a lot of mineralization is in areas where you had a lot of fumaroles along mid-ocean ridges. If you've seen the videos where you see the exotic like plant life and creatures that form near mid-ocean ridges or live along the mid-ocean ridges, those black smokers that you see the videos of, those are pouring out a lot of metals. And those essentially get embedded in the interstices of the lavas. And you know, in this case, even though it's been heavily metamorphosed, this unit is upright, essentially. So that's why it kind of trends in a nice long, it doesn't really care about the topography. It just runs back and forth because it's lying in there nearly vertical. And that's essentially where the mineralized rock is located. The areas on both sides of these are a variety of different intrusives that intruded into this rock, into this rock, and there's not much of it left. If you sort of look around, these are all different types of intrusives that have invaded into this original schist. You can see its little stringers that are running through here over the course of the last 100 million years or so.
So the mineral copper is going to be right at one of the edges between one type of rock and another type of rock?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The in that type of sequence, usually you have the more copper-rich towards the bottom of the sequence and the more zinc-rich near the top. In this case, because this whole entire package has actually been turned over upside down, it's opposite. So what they have is they had more copper-rich kind of in this direction and then more zinc-rich towards the other side. It's not, and I wouldn't want to say, this doesn't actually show the mineral distribution, it just shows the host rock. You know, they spent, we were talking about this the other day, they spent a lot of effort drilling over along Martin's Ridge looking for more ore deposits. And I was down on a job in Colombia a couple of years ago looking at rock mechanic type stuff, and they were drilling for a mine site, and probably similar to what they did here, labor is really cheap in third world countries, and so instead of having like a helicopter move something around, they have 15 local folks get a couple of ropes and pieces of wood, and they just carry the drill rigs. So I'm sure that back in the day, that's what they did when they were looking around for more ore. But my understanding is that the ore goes deep, and it doesn't extend in either direction. So the copper reserves that they were looking for, that's why they mined so deep, is that they were following the reserves. And it didn't extend, you know, they drilled all the way, I think, to like Buckskin and Copper Peak at one time, looking for other reserves, and they sort of ran out. And part of the shutdown was just that trying to dewater the mine at depth was quite expensive and difficult. So
Jamie, before you switch this photo, when they were drilling for where they were going to locate the rock quarry, they were drilling there in kind of that tan or brown rock.
Yeah, they're over here, and that's a and I'll have a couple of pictures of that. It's a little bit more. This is a little closer. So it's a depends on who you want to look at. The map over there says that it's just a sort of a granite like. The regional map says they lump that together with what's called an orthognice, which really is just a granite that's been cooked a little bit. So this, it's hard to tell, but that it should be sort of some sort of relatively durable granite. Ideally, it is an orthognice, because one of the problems they had with the original mine work was that they just hauled granite in that was from a different source. It had a lot of microfractures in the crystals, and they just fell apart. I don't know if anybody has looked along the creek channel there, but that used to be all nice granite riprap, and it's just turned to dirt.
Yeah. So if you go back one slide. So when where they got the original was down towards Lucerne in that yellow and red.
Yep. Exactly.
Stuff. And so when they were drilling over here, we kept arguing for them to look further away from the village. Not right, because originally they started on the 10-mile trail, and now they're just on the other side of 10-mile.
Right.
And they kept saying, well, we can't because there's not, the rock changes.
And that's, you know, it probably makes a lot of sense, because you go a little bit past 10-mile and we get into a different intrusive rock. An Eocene granite rock that may not be as durable, just for that very reason, where the material here has undergone some degree of metamorphism or secondary metamorphism that may have made it more of a durable rock for a long-term performance. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that most of that rock that the ore body was in is, at least from the surface picture here, is more on dumbbell than on copper?
Yeah, and I've got a slide here coming up. If you look, copper is a big intrusive. You go climb on copper, and most of it's actually intrusive rock. There is some down low, and you know they've drilled into copper, and so underneath copper, because it's not a vertical body. It kind of goes in at an angle like this, at maybe 70 degrees or so. So underneath copper is probably where some of the reserves are, but at the ground surface, it's actually a big granitic intrusive. So. Slightly closer view. Here's dumbbell again. This is actually on the other geologic map. This is called the dumbbell granite. So and that actually extends up and is part of Bonanza Peak. This is the Cloudy Pass intrusive. These are some younger, less deformed, again maybe less durable in that case rocks.
Jamie, going back a long time, people were saying that Bonanza Peak is bad rock for climbing. Is there, you know, it's just not that safe. It's brittle, it breaks. It wasn't granite or something. Maybe it's granite. I don't know. The talk was that's not a very safe place to be climbing.
And you know, there's a lot of faulting and fracturing of this rock that isn't really shown here. So it may be that the areas that were climbing accessible, it was more the fractures of the rock and not necessarily the rock type that was causing it to be less good. And it may be this rock has also gone under certain levels of deformation.
or secondary heating and metamorphism. Depending on those conditions, it may or may not have made it a better rock. So that's interesting. I hadn't heard
that. Are the black lines, they're all fractures?
They are actually fairly major faults. This just shows some of them. If you go to the more detailed map, there's even more faults in the area. So this is, again, at the 100,000 level view, they only put on some of the significant features. One significant one is this one running right through here, and that actually is what the schists that the holding mine ore are located in are basically cut off by. So that fault, the schists don't actually extend past that fault. So there's been displacement along that. There's essentially moved the schists either down or they've been moved up and they've been eroded away. I suspect down in this case. So most people are familiar with this view. I took this last night because it was a great view. You can really just see the schists and the layering in the rock. That was probably the original layering from when it was laid down, and now it's been sort of brought up and over. So it's upside down from where it was originally. And then I took this one at a different sunlight view, and you can see how this is this dark gray granite-looking rock type. So your contact sort of runs through the valley floor here, and probably right up off to the top there.
Where was that one taken from?
This one was taken from this was a rest stop about halfway up top of Martin's Ridge. So directly above Timah Creek.
Near the Kendall Trail?
Yeah. Yeah, above that. So you've done the switchbacks going up there and pushed through the alders and underbrush, so I'm breaking out onto the more open slopes up there. Just some photographs of so this is the rock that they're mining, actually. I guess from that standpoint, it's undergone some level of deformation. That's obviously the viewpoint. Here's a lot of hornblende, which would make me this more often a secondary mineral than a primary, which makes me think that it has undergone some level of deformation. Here's a view looking along Martin's Ridge. He's got the schist here, and then somewhere around in here is the orthognice contact running through there. And you'll see it if you walk along that ridge. It'll start out, as you gain the ridge, it's mostly the salt and pepper rock. And as you continue on, you'll start, we call it float, so it's basically rock that's not intact, but it's resting on the surface. You'll start to see float rock that's actually got some banding in it. Actually, I'll be right back. I forgot my rocks, they're just out in the hall here. Some samples. All right. So some of these are easier to see than other from viewpoint. I'll just hand these around. This is probably more of an unmetamorphosed and a metamorphosed intrusive. If you look at the minerals, they're fairly randomly assembled and there's no sort of banding to them. And then this would probably be more of a gneiss. You might be able to see from there that there's a lineation of fabric to the rock. The biotites in these and elongated minerals tend to grow in a manner that's minimum energy for the mineral. So it's easiest to grow perpendicular to the maximum stress. So if you're trying to squish on something, a flat mineral wants to grow so that it's not trying to grow against the stress conditions of the rock.
If you walk out 10 miles just past the first lookout, on the left, there was a tree across there, and there was like a little pile of what looks like crushed salt I mean, it's actually a rock, and when you pick it up, you can break it in your hand. What is that?
You know, that's probably weathered granite or weathered gneiss. So, you know, it looks the exact same, sounds the exact same as what happened to the riprap, the granite riprap along the creek bed there. A lot of times what happens is the water gets into the cracks of the rock, and it'll sort of hold its form, but it's basically like a Rubik's, you know, cube that's just, and that's a very common fabric to a granitic rock as it weathers. It's just kind of...
So it's kind of porous when the water gets in there and sort of separates it a little bit.
And then bruises it, yeah, exactly. Let's see, so here's another rock. This was actually, this is the gneiss, unmineralized gneiss that's at the top of Martin's Ridge. And you can see really well-developed banding in that, mineral banding. It's schist gneiss is, it's more close to a gneiss than a schist, honestly, just an appearance. There are some more, these dark rocks are made up almost entirely of magnesium and iron-rich minerals. There are some, and these are often like a more of a volcanic origin, and these are found around there.
Are those the ones that make up the scree slopes?
Not necessarily. The scree slopes, so, you know, actually, like on Buckskin, if you climb up there, as you're going up the ridge to the summit, there's a lot of slaty rock, and that's just, that's probably more the schists that are up there, which makes it fairly precarious to get up that ridgeline. This is, as I was walking along on Martin's Ridge, I was surprised myself by finding an andesite, which is a type of lava rock that is fairly, I just didn't expect it here, and it's probably some sort of a shallow dike, so some sort of event that took place that erupted these. You can see the white minerals are fragile clays, and a dike is basically, for those that weren't here on Monday, is where lava intrudes into the ground, but it's in a vertical orientation. So if it intruded horizontally, it would be a sill. So it's not really indicating a type of rock. It's just it's more of a geometry, a geometric relationship. But if you hike up there, you'll actually see some of those. And I didn't find one actually in place, but someone who's got better eyes probably could find that. So I was going to also talk a little bit about glacial features here in the valley. You know, this is a world-class view of glaciology here at Holden, and I'm sure folks can start looking at all these features and just seeing Holden everywhere. You know, hanging valleys where you've got a glacier coming in, and it was eroding rock or riding at a different elevation in the main valley glacier. And it basically just dumped into the valley glacier, but when it retreats, you're left with this sharp contact here. Small lakes up high, perhaps Holden Lake or Lyman Lakes, little cirques that may or may not have water in them, horns, which are sort of peaks that are left as the glacier has eroded around it, and sort of fins or arêtes that are ridgelines left behind by the glaciers.
What's the difference between a tarn and a
cirque? Yeah. I was kind of wondering that too. In my opinion, not much. I think the tarn is actually a small lake, like not a large lake. Maybe Upper Lyman is more of a tarn. Versus a larger body of water.
And Dull Lakes would be the Paternoster. Three in a row.
You gotta have three of them in a row.
Is that what?
No, I think they're just honestly. I think they're just small remnant ponds that are left over. Again, I'm not sure I can tell you the difference between is the difference between the tarn and the Paternoster Lakes numbers or single. That I'm not sure. I'm not sure I can tell you that one. So this is up in Alaska. And just mostly, you know, sort of showing active glaciology. You know, here are several glaciers that are coming in. This is the main valley glacier. Maybe that's, you know, the Holden, the Railroad Creek drainage. And so, you know, obviously ongoing today, leaving deposits of morainal deposits along the sides. I'll talk about this a little bit more, but you can see that as the glacier moves along, it's dumping stuff. It's not just taking everything down with it. It also leaves a lot of material on the side. If you looked at the geologic maps, there's quite a deposit well up the sides of Holden or the railroad creek drainage that are associated with just morainal deposits being left in place there. So this was my opening slide, but it's a great slide because you get a really good sense of the sort of classic U-shaped valley that glaciers create. I was trying to find like a smiley face, but they all kept like wanting to be blocks, and I didn't want that. But this is right off of Martin's Ridge, looking right up 10 Mile Creek.
Jamie,
I'm sorry.
What's alluvial? That's another.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, sure. Alluvial are water-derived soil deposits. So water transported soil deposits. So they're basically anything that silt, sand, gravel that water takes down and leaves in an area. So
after the glacier melts and the water carries it further, does that make it alluvial, or does it have to be out when there's not a glacier?
You know, I probably misspoke. The moraines and the morainal deposits are not alluvial deposits. They're glacial deposits. Alluvial deposits are just like what. Say stream coming off of a glacier, the gravels and silts and sands that those streams carry off with it are the actual alluvial deposits. The morainal deposits underneath it or on the sides are not actually alluvial, so
okay,
they're glacial. Yeah.
No, the alluvial rock is round; it has no sharp edges from the hydraulic action of being tumbled.
Right. Yep. It can be challenging sometimes as glaciers move forward and backward. If a glacier moves forward and then it retreats and leaves a bunch of alluvium and then it pushes again, it's going to churn all those up. So then you've got both. And sometimes that it's tricky to sort of pick out the difference. Very familiar looking valley. And I've just named a variety of those. I can't remember. It's been several years since I was way up in Copper if there's an actual pond there or if it's just a meadow at this point.
There's no
lake left, basically, so it's been sort of filled in. I suspect there might have been one at one time, but it's gone now. Anybody who's ever hiked up or skied down this slope knows that that's a hanging valley. That is a challenging place to maneuver, whether on foot or on skis. Glaciers leave a very polished surface where they run along. This is just up from the falls. If you continue up the trail, there's a beautiful exposure of glacial polish on the rock. You can see that in several places along Martin's Ridge, and I'm sure in lots of other places in the valley, but it's just next time you're walking along, you're wondering why it's such a smooth surface. The glacier will have entrained in it lots of little pieces of rock. And so it's just like a polisher, and these rocks just sort of scour along that and create this nice smooth surface that you see. And a lot of times, it's kind of hard to see. There might be some striations that are sort of running along like this. I'm not sure the resolution of the photograph can really show that. So the last part that I wanted to talk a little bit about is glacial deposits. Here's a terminal moraine, lateral moraines. Till is material that's typically been ridden over by the glacier, so it's often very dense. It's often blue-gray, it's just ground-up rock that's been compressed to near rock-like conditions sometimes. Outwash plains, those would be the alluvial material, rounded gravels. A lot of times these are very coarse-grained. Here at Holden we have quite a bit of this material in the valley. It's actually one of the challenges for the mine project because it's really hard to stop water from flowing through these. And it'll transport water downstream quite rapidly and efficiently. There are also lacustrine deposits that are formed in, here's a glacial lake or a lake that's receiving probably glacial wash. And you can see these sort of light gray layers. The lacustrine deposits are basically fine silts and sands, mostly fine silts that are deposited in lakes, and when they're exposed, you see these really thin layers of that are the silts that sort of stacked on top of each other. We actually have those in the valley. So here's Holden, and Railroad Creek has cut into the bank over on this side, just upstream from the mine area. And if you go up there, you gotta go on the other side of the creek. But if you go up there, there's till up there, but there's also lacustrine deposits. I was talking with some folks yesterday or the day before. One of the questions is, how do we create a lake here in the valley to allow these kinds of sediments to deposit? So one option is that the glacier came down and it stopped, created a terminal dam or a terminal glacier, and then retreated, and behind that there was a little lake that formed. The other thought that sort of came up with is that it's harder to maintain a glacier in a big valley because you need a lot of ice feeding into it for it to continue to flow downhill. But you don't need anywhere near as much to fill a 10-mile creek. And it's also a higher elevation drainage. So one thought that I had is that maybe we had an ice dam in the valley at one time. And so the glacier from 10 Mile came down and filled this in. It's a narrower drainage and created a backwater here that allowed for some sort of a silt deposit to develop and is now exposed in Railroad Creek Range. So it's just upstream from the ballpark, and so access isn't very good right now in that area.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
So, I'm confused.
Sure.
What's the lake you're talking about?
No problem.
Hypothesizing that there is a lake?
Well, there are deposits upstream of Holden that are exposed in the creek, sidewalls of the creek, that are lacustrine deposits. So basically, they're deposits that you'd see if you were able to core into the lake. And so the question is, well, how do you know that you only get them when you have a lake present. So how do you get a lake in the Holden Valley? And
we're looking at Holden. This is looking.
I could explain this better. So here's Holden. Google says there's a lodge here. You go down. This is going right down Railroad Creek right here, and this is 10 Mile Creek right here coming through here. So my thought was that you could have had a glacier coming through here and actually creating an ice dam. That was clicked off of Google Earth about 6:45 tonight. This last slide is actually the Chilliwack terrain. This is at the upstream side of the dam, showing the sort of amazing deformation of the rocks that has occurred during its positioning along the North American crust. So that's all I've got. So questions? Yeah.
Can you explain how it comes that there's so many faults on the map you had of the valley? It's just all those black lines and they're crossing all kinds of topographic.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exposure is limiting, so sometimes you're challenged to how much you can do as far as defining how far an individual feature goes. A lot of times those are mapped via like an aerial photograph, so you're looking at lineaments. So maybe just a fracture zone, faults don't go forever. So a lot of times what you're looking at as well, it accommodated stress in the rock over this period by fracturing, right, and maybe displacing, and then it terminates, but that stress is accommodated by another joint somewhere else, another fracture zone somewhere else. So I didn't put the lines on that particular map, so I'm not sure how far I would want to say. I could say that one, there's one that runs right over Martin's Ridge, and I stood on that, and I'm like, yeah, I call that a fault pretty readily. Those might be fractured. Some of those might be fractured zones. Some are probably some more significant faults.
Is that number common in other
Mountain terrains that have been heavily deformed? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And And that's probably, you know, if you went to the map up up in the museum, you'd see even more and probably different ones because they're a different scale of map.
When you say heavily deformed, do you mean like y'all
have
intrusion going on?
Well, the intrusion and also, you know, when all these terrains were sort of combined, you know, they, in order to take something that's this big and make it this big, it's going to be thrust on top of each other. It's going to just be compressed so that you fracture the rock and maybe thicken it. And so you damage the rock quite substantially when that happens. You know, here's a rock that was laid down horizontally at one time. And so part of the way it handled being compressed is it just started to create these sort of folds, this intricate folding that you see in the rock exposure. There's a fault here. I'm not sure I can pick it out right off the bat. Maybe it's this one right here that probably went up like this to again try to accommodate that compression that's going on there and make space.
And do the faults indicate the possibility of earthquakes then too or not?
You know, these are pretty old structures. So, you know, in this case, those faults and the faults that we see on the Holden map are not active. I'm not actually sure where the nearest active fault is from Holden.
We had an earthquake
Was it? It was pretty. You could feel it pretty well.
It showed up on the USGS. Someone looked it up as a 4 or something.
Oh, and that's a pretty good earthquake.
I felt it 3.
It was felt here.
Upstairs.
It was. Yeah. Oh, wow. Awesome.
Is Lake Chenard a fault?
You know, it is. There is a fault that runs down Lake Chelan.
And that's
you know, and the glaciers love to take advantage of those faults, and so you know, it basically took advantage of the weakened rock and scoured it out, made it an easy path for the rock. Yeah. So, other questions? I'm free. Feel free to.